I'm Larry Collins, and I'm the geologist in the village. And if you have any questions about rocks, I'll be a lot more comfortable talking about that than this particular area tonight, and I'll do the best I can on it. So the title of the evening's talk is Creation Science and the Genesis Week. And because I am out of my area a bit, I think I need to set my credentials for you so that you know from where I'm coming. I am a geologist and a layperson. I'm not a theologian. I know that I'm a committed Christian. And I did take a year off to go to seminary, so I have that interest as well. I have coordinated a number of lay witness missions and have been doing so for about 10 years now, so I do go out with groups of lay people to churches and witness for Christ and have that kind of a commitment. I understand the Lutheran Church has picked up this program and they call it the Lay Renewal Weekend instead of a Lay Witness Weekend, and so you people are doing the same thing. I believe that the Bible is the Word of God, and since He's inspired it, what's in the Bible is true. And however, I'm going to come up with a different interpretation than many of you have been taught, and it's perfectly all right to disagree with me, but I think we need to have some different viewpoints. I do disagree with the creation scientists, and we're quite aware of a number of trials that are in process. There is the one in Arkansas where the creation scientists attempted to put in law that the biblical story must be taught in the school, public school systems, and all of the arguments for it. So I think it's a hot issue at the present moment. The history of the problem, I think, has developed over the last 150 years. Prior to this time, there hasn't been much of a problem because everybody has agreed that the biblical story on Genesis, with the 6-day week of creation and the 7th day in which God rested, has been believed verbatim, literally. And it's only when science has come along, chemistry and physics and astronomy and biology and particularly geology now, that there's been some question about that. Geologists have begun to realize, because of the studies, that there is good evidence to believe that the Earth and the universe and so on is not created in 6 days, but it was in a much greater length of time. And because of this, there has become a separation between the church, quote, and scientists. And it's created, I think, three different camps of people. Because of the disagreement on the theory of evolution in the Bible, and the disagreement about Noah's flood covering the whole world, the scientists are saying one thing, and those who do a biblical, literal interpretation of the Bible are saying just the opposite. Let me just classify these three groups of people for you so that I think you can see where I think we are at the present moment. There are those who have listened to the scientists and have said, heard them say that the Bible isn't right in the sense that a 24-hour day. And they said, well, if you can't believe the Bible, you can't trust anything about the Bible. And they have turned their backs to Christianity and gone their separate ways. These are many of them intelligent people, and they look at what modern science and the evidence is there and said, well, you just can't trust the Bible, and we'll just forget about church and religion. There is a second group of people that I would classify who are scientists who have said, yes, what we believe is true about science, you can trust the natural laws and all of this, but we scientists think, that the Bible was never intended to be a science book, that it was a book of religion, that it offered truth about religious faith and this sort of thing, and it was just never intended to be a science book. And so they have developed and believe in a good science, but they have a rather poor theology. And if you continue in that vein, it will eventually be the destruction of a biblical religious faith. The third group of people largely are in the camp of what I would call biblical literalists, and they insist that there is a 24-hour day period, and that Noah's flood did actually occur, and that it did cover the whole earth, and that evolution is not in fact true, but God made a special creation for each of the life forms. I think these people basically have a good theology, but they have very bad science. And so if we continue in that vein, if you go that route, the only conclusion is that there must be a death of science in that direction. I'm going to suggest to you that there is a fourth alternative, that all three of these camps are wrong, that it is possible to have both a good biblical theology and also still have good science. And this is not my own idea. In the last 2 weeks, I've found a couple of books. I brought them along with me. There's a book called Creation and the Flood, An Alternative to Flood Theology and Theistic Evolution by David A. Young. This came out in 1977. It's published by Baker Company. David A. Young is a well-regarded geologist. I highly respect him in his own field and have no problem with his geology. He's a son of a theologian and has a firm background in theology, and he's right on target there. He has since published an additional book that just came out this year called Christianity and the Age of the Earth, in which he discusses much of what I'm not going to have time to talk about tonight, so I hope to get into some of it. On the opposite side, there's a book called The World That Perished by John C. Whitcomb, Jr., published by also by Baker Company. This other book by Young, Christianity and Age of the Earth, is published by Donovan. Whitcomb and Morris also published the book The Genesis Flood, in which the two authors have argued back and forth which is right. At any rate, I highly recommend these books to you as sources to go to if you want more information after I'm through today. Let me just give you now quickly the two sides so that you can sort of help judge for yourself where people stand. What is creation science now? It is the belief that you can prove a literal interpretation of the Bible with the use of science. I actually have a statement up here from the Creation Research Society of what those who join that society say that they believe, but I think in the limits of time I won't read that statement to you. At any rate, this belief is one that the earth is 6,000 to 20,000 years old and no older. And most people would prefer 6,000 maybe to 10,000, but not beyond that, but some would go as much as 20,000 years at least. They believe that there was a worldwide flood. They believe that there is insufficiency of mutation and natural selection to bring about complex life forms, that is Darwin's theory of evolution. Okay? They believe that there is a separate ancestry between the queen man and the ape. They're entirely separate from each other. And finally, they believe that the earth was supernaturally created by God. And this is their firm belief. Now, what I want to do for you now is to take three aspects of this. One, the age of the earth. The second would be the worldwide flood idea. And third, the idea of evolution. And to give you the viewpoint from the person who would be a creationist, how he would debate this and the evidence for it. And then I want to give you the contrasting view of the scientist, how he would argue against that. And obviously I'm prejudiced, so you'll have to keep that in mind. In regard to the age of the earth, 6,000 to 20,000 years, what is the scientific evidence for this? What would they say? Well, first of all, you can go to the Bible, and you can go through it and look at the number of generations, the so-called begat, so-and-so, begat, so-and-so, and you can come through the line. And there are a number of different ideas that come up with this. the book here documents that for you. One of these is the idea that the earth had to be created about 4004 BC, if you calculate these things back. I think Bishop Usher came up with this. The second idea is that if you look at the literature, and these people are very carefully go through the scientific literature looking for things to support this, is that one scientist reported that the Canary Islands, around the islands, the sediment around there could not be any older than about 5,000 to 10,000 years in age. And they immediately jumped on this. Aha, if you've got a scientist saying this, there's proof right there. Okay? The third thing is that they found a scientific report in which the scientists indicated that they had found meteorites, and these meteorites were no more than 10,000 years old. They say, aha, here's meteorites coming in from outer space, and we have an age of 10,000 years reported for them. The fourth thing, some of the scientific studies they discovered by observing the sun with very careful astronomical instruments, that the diameter of the sun is decreasing at the rate of about 5 feet per year. The sun is getting smaller and smaller and smaller. If you go in the opposite direction in terms of length of time, if you go back a few hundred billion years or so, eventually the sun gets so large it would engulf the earth, and therefore obviously we couldn't be that old if the sun is going to be that big. Another fact that they discovered, a number of people do radioactive dating techniques, and there is a number of places in which geologists have dated some lava flows. In the early 1800s, these lava flows, actually they observed them come out, they're historical flows, and they've gone out and taken samples of these. And the samples turn out not to be 100 years old, but the samples give dates indicating several 100,000 years old or a billion years old. And if they look, you can't even trust these radioactive dates if they get these crazy answers on something that we can observe. So you just can't believe what these scientists are doing. And they say that the carbon-14 dates are unreliable. They've also used atomic clocks. And by using atomic clocks, we now know that the Earth is spinning at a very much slower and slower rate. And you can actually gets the years getting longer and longer. If you go back to geologic time at the rate at which it's slowing down, if the Earth is really very old, then the Earth ought to be spinning so fast that it ought to flatten out, and people wouldn't be able to, animals wouldn't be able to stay on it at the rate of spin it would be. They've also noted that the present rate of erosion in continents, the streams coming off, if the Earth is very, very old, then at the present rate of erosion, there should not be any land sticking up out of water. It ought to all be long ago eroded down and dumped into the sea, and we ought to be just underwater all the time. So, and then finally they say if meteorites have been coming in all the time through this length of time, we ought to find through the stratigraphic record pieces of meteorites all the way down, but all we ever find are those on the surface. And so these are the arguments they use that the Earth is very young. Now let me switch quickly to the worldwide flood. They will point to fish fossils in Wyoming that you can find 7,000 feet high above sea level. Evidence of the flood, that high up. Okay? Or you can find in Utah, for example, around the Great Salt Lake area, old shorelines at 5,000 feet above sea level, all the way around the mountains there. And there's evidence of the water needs to be at the high level. There are some places where you can actually find trees standing vertically 50 feet high, and they're buried in sediment, layer upon layer. And they say if the Earth is really very old, taking millions of years to deposit those sediments, why, that tree should have rotted out a long time ago. It just couldn't last a million years, it still stays standing vertically. There are places in France where you can find 1,000 feet above the lowlands there on the side of the mountain, a crevice there in which you can find fossils of bear and wolves and horses and oxen. And these animals don't normally live together, and the argument is that when the flood came, these animals rushed up the side of the mountain to get away from the flood and fell into this crevasse, their crevice up there, and got drowned and buried there. You can also find that if you look at many different cultures, in the Eskimo or the Aborigine in Australia or in Africa or wherever, all these 80 different cultures, each one have a tradition of a flood sometime in their history. So this is an argument for the flood. In Canada and Siberia, they have found literally probably millions of fossils of mammoths buried there. And this is supposed to be evidence of the flood being true. In the Grand Canyon, you can find layer upon layer upon layer of sediment, and you don't find any evidence of erosion between these layers. So the argument is that during this big flood, these sediments settled out of the water and deposited in that system. Finally, another argument they use is that if you go to Texas and some of the stream canyons there, you can find enormous footprints of dinosaur steps, where the dinosaur stepped in the mud, stride upon stride, 15, 20 feet between footprints. And right beside it is a giant footprint of a human being, stride by stride, going down across it. So the argument is, look, man lived way back in the dinosaur time. Okay? So these are the kinds of things that could present an argument for the flood. Evolution. They would argue against a gradual change that evolutionists would believe in, or have suggested to believe in terms of Darwin, that there was an abrupt, you find through the geologic records, a very abrupt appearance of very complicated forms, the first forms occurring in the Cambrian, and we just have all the multitude of different fauna and flora that just suddenly appear. So they argue for a creation at that point. They say if there was, so they're asking, where are the missing links between all of these forms? And why don't you find, let's say, an amphibian that's converting to a reptile? Why don't you find something that's 10% amphibian and 90% reptile and 40% and 60%, and you see all the gradual changes? And you just don't find that. They also argue with the second law of thermodynamics. And this essentially says that heat always flows downhill, or that if you have something that's ordered in time, it'll become more and more disordered, or that if you start with something that's complex, it will break down and become more and more simple. And if you look at the fossil record, you go from the simple and you become more and more complex with time. And so it disobeys the second law of thermodynamics. They also would argue with you about the laws of chance. In the human body, for example, there are something like 20 different amino acids that are put together to form the various proteins that we have. And in order to get these in the proper order, if it was truly by chance that this would happen, the laws of chance say that couldn't happen in 10 and 40,000th power, or something like that. It's just so phenomenal that it just argues against it. They also say, well, change does occur, and we're quite aware, for example, in England, when people started burning a lot more coal over there. There normally used to be moths that fly around through the woods, and they were perfectly white. And as they burned more and more coal, then the soot began to cover the trees, and the trees became black, and these white moths would land on the trees, and they were obvious targets for any bird to catch them. They were not camouflaged anymore. And so through time, these moths would evolve and become black wings, and then they would be perfectly camouflaged. And they say, that's okay. You can have that kind of evolution, but you still haven't got a new form. It's still moth. Okay? So God does allow for those kinds of changes. So they would argue with you that if the evolutionary theory is wrong, then the Bible must be right. Okay? Okay, now I'm going to switch over and take the other side and come down and look at the other side of the argument. Let's go back to the age of the earth. Geologists think that it's probably 4.5 to 6 billion years in age, not 6,000. And they base this primarily with radioactive dating techniques, and they have used many different kinds of isotopes, each of which gives the same age, and so it's an independent type of judgment. At the Canary Islands, where you had that area where the scientists did say that that was 5,000 years in age and couldn't be any older, when that was written, we did not know that the Canary Islands were the result of the Atlantic Ocean being split and opening up and new lava coming up, and that we have a whole volcanic mountain chain because the continents are spreading apart and opening up the Atlantic Ocean. And so this is a very young area which has just emerged out of the ocean floor, and we should expect 5,000 very young sediments there. We just didn't know that when that was written. I think most of you are familiar with tree rings. And every year, the tree adds a new layer of growth around there, and we represent an annual ring, and we have to use it to date time with that. If you go to a modern-day glacial area, where sediment is coming off of the glaciers, out in the lakes below there, in the summertime you get runoff and you deposit a white sandy layer. In the wintertime, the algae in the lakes die and settle out and you get a very carbonaceous layer. And we can put a stake in the middle of the lake and watch these layers accumulate year after year. And we can see an annual ring of deposit of sediment. And we can observe it happening today. Then we can look at older glacial lakes, and we can drill down through the same kind of mud and see the same kinds of layers, and we can count 200,000 bars, meaning that that lake has been 200,000 years in age. And that's not 6,000, that's 200,000, just for the lake right there, and we can see the evidence. If we go to that article that they referred to about the meteorite that was 10,000 years in age, we discovered that the scientist was not talking about a meteorite, and they have misinterpreted and misunderstood what he was talking about. It's actually a tektite. And a tektite is a chunk of molten glass, and it was a result of collision of a meteorite that hit with such force that it melted the rock. And what the scientist was measuring was the length of time in which that molten material was traveling through outer space before it arrived at Earth. And he was measuring the amount of cosmic ray damage. It was 10,000 years while it was in space. But when he measured the actual age of the meteorite, it was 100,000 years in age. So the creation scientists have misused and misunderstood and quoted the wrong thing. In respect to the lavas in which they observed these unusual ages, scientists acknowledge that we do have problems in certain cases and that you can't use those kind of dates, and there's a reason for it. These lavas erupted into cold water, and there's a lot of argon gas. And the method is a potassium argon gas method. And as soon as that lava hits the cold water, it immediately forms a glass and hardens and traps all the gas in there, and so it has an extra amount of argon gas, and you will get crazy dates from those things occur. And they're aware of this. But if you apply them to other situations where you don't have these problems, you get consistent dates that are very dependable and consistent worldwide, and there's no problem with it. And scientists recognize those kinds of problems. I think I'll just, you could go on and on with this, and my time is running out, and I want to give you some time to talk as well. Let me move on. Let me just say that in every case, we discover that the creation scientists have had either bad science or misquoted or pulled things out of context and have not really understood them. And these people and other people have refuted almost everything that has been presented as arguments in science in favor of it. Let's go to the worldwide flood. I can do these people one better if you say fossil fish can be found 7,000 feet high in Wyoming, while you can go to Mount Everest, which is 29,000 feet high, and you can find marine fossils clear up on top of the peak there. And we now know why it's there. India, as we now understand plate tectonics and continental drift, used to be down next to the southern tip of Africa, which used to be down at the South Pole, and between India and Asia was a shallow sea. And through geologic time, these continental plates have drifted apart, and India has broken loose, and it's slid northward along the coast of Africa, and it's plowed through this shallow sea and pushed it together and crumpled it up and formed the Himalaya Mountains. And it's just lifted these shallow water marine fossils right up out of the water and piled them up in these enormously 29,000 foot peaks. We now understand what's going on. It takes a long time in order for that to happen. Lake Bonneville. This is the name of that big lake that I told you about that the Great Salt Lake is. During the glacial age, there was huge meltwater runoff and lots of lakes accumulated, and we do have these great big lakes, and now they have evaporated down to the point that all that's left is the Great Salt Lake Flat. But these are local things, and you don't find that same shoreline elevation worldwide. It's only right at the margins of the glaciers where you've got this big water accumulation. Those who believe in a very slow settling, I talked about that sea that was standing vertically, that had horizontal sediments in there. We do have catastrophic events in which you get sudden inundation of areas. The 200-year flood in California, when suddenly there's enormous rain and water comes down, and it'll come out into a shoreline and just bury the whole sediment there. We do have catastrophic situations like Mount St. Helens blowing its top, and I'm sure that there are trees standing around and have been buried up to their tips with ice. And we don't say that this happened worldwide. It's just in a local event, and those kinds of things do happen periodically. The mammoths in Siberia, the several hundred thousands of these, some of these are actually buried in sediments, and because of the cold climate, you can actually find preserved actual flesh. Some of these are looking almost as fresh as the day that they were interred. I just heard a talk this last year by a geologist who's studying glaciers in, I think it was Alaska area, in which the glacier during the wintertime comes down off the mountain and comes across the valley and walls up the valley with a big mass of ice. In the summertime melting, the stream coming down that valley piles up as a huge lake behind it. And then suddenly the pressure gets up enough that it melts its way through and it goes out in a huge flood. I can just picture some grazing herds of mammoths right below there, and suddenly this big wall of water comes rushing down, and they all get drowned and buried and frozen in the tundra up there, and you've got a catastrophe. If this happens year after year, you're going to have lots of mammoths buried there, and so it's quite possible. The fossil footprints. Down in Texas with these huge dinosaur footprints and the human forms there, I have not seen these. I've only talked to a few geologists that have. If you look at the footprints of the dinosaurs, you can see where the enormous weight of these animals pushed into the mud. And if those of you, as children, have walked in the mud, you know how the mud squeezes up around your toes and in there. If you look at the footprints around the dinosaurs, the mud is squeezed up. You can see the flow lines in the mud. But if you look at the footprints of the human beings walking along there, there's no evidence of any squeezing up between the toes. A perfect imprint of toes and heels and everything there. I have a feeling that this is a hoax, that somebody has gone through and carved these things in order to demonstrate it. I don't know. When I talked to a man in my own congregation about this, giving a similar presentation, said, oh, I used to live in that area. I grew up as a kid. I used to go down to that area where the dinosaurs. I don't remember any footprints there. So I'm a little wonder. I mean, they could have been there and he could have missed them, but I sort of wonder about it. Okay, evolution. We do find an abrupt appearance in the Cambrian, sudden life forms. I don't know the answer here. We do find that in order for fossils to be preserved, you have to have hard parts, and we do have evidence of older rocks that have imprints of soft parts, and they're just cast. So there could have been a long period of evolution in which animals have developed through time, and then for some reason, we don't know why, developed hard parts, and we'll find all these preserved. In terms of missing links, there was an argument that we never have a missing link between, say, reptiles and birds or something like that or whatever. And then they found six archaeopteryx reptiles with feathers and wings and so on, and we found the missing link. Now, these are very poor missing links, and a lot of things are still missing there, so we don't know for sure. One of the problems with the fossil record is that it's very hard to, or very difficult to bury fossils. Anything that lives on the land, the rain and the wind, the oxidation soon destroys them, and then you have no evidence of it. And I'm guessing it probably takes 10,000 to 100,000 individuals before you finally find one that falls in the right place to be preserved as a fossil. And if you look at the cephalopods, which are a kind of animal, something like an octopus that lives in a shell, you can find progressively when it first formed, all of their fears, all of their changes. There are no missing links. You can see all the steps. And these are animals that are preserved in the wildlife. There is a man that recently found a snail in Africa in which he can trace all of the evolutionary changes of a new species in this lake. And apparently it was a huge lake at one time, and it slowly evaporated down to a very small area. And a portion of it got set aside and began to get hot, and the snails began to evolve to adjust to the conditions. And you see all kinds of new forms adjusting until one finally adapted to the conditions. And then the lake level rose, and that snail was able to get out of that area and spread out and go all over the world again. But you had a local condition that caused the snail to evolve and change and adjust to it. And you don't find the missing link everywhere else. It just suddenly appears because it got out of that lake and then was able to move around to other places. The second law of thermodynamics. The argument here would indicate that we're really not a closed system. If we were a completely closed system with no energy coming in, that's what we'd expect. That we're not a closed system. The sun is out there and it's continually giving us energy, so it's possible that we can go from the simple to the complex because we're getting energy transfer coming in. I've probably got 15 minutes left. I want to give you people some time to talk. Let me, rather than go on with the arguments here, what the scientists would say if the evolutionary theory is wrong, and I think many scientists are not happy with what Darwin has presented. We're changing some new ideas on this. So it's not that the Bible necessarily is right, but we just need more information. And so we're all constantly looking for new fossils, new different information, and hope that sometime we might find the answer. And the issue, let me just give you a quick illustration of why this is bad science. Stars, according to Genesis' story, are supposed to have been created on the fourth day. If they're created on the fourth day, then since that day and 6,000, 20,000 years ago, starlight could have come from the stars to come to Earth. By using careful scientific methods, we're actually able to measure the distance to these stars, so we know how far they're away. We know that the speed of light is 186,000 miles per second. We can calculate how long it takes for that to get there, and some of these stars are so far away that the light would have had to left there 100,000 years ago, or a billion years ago. And so if this is true, then it could not have been created 6,000 years ago, or you have to say not only did God create that star on the fourth day, but he also created the light streaming from that star to arrive at the Earth so that we know that it's here. Now you can do that, and God has that capability, but that's not science. That's faith that God did it this way. Okay? The creation scientists are trying with great effort to say, they appeal to your emotions of fair play. Why don't we allow, if you have this theory about teaching science, why don't we allow the Genesis theory to be taught? It's just unfair that you ought to be allowed with. Well, if we had somebody who believed in the flat Earth theory, and I could argue with you people right now that the Earth is not spinning, we're sitting perfectly still right now, you don't have any sense of moving, but I'm telling you right now you're going about 900 miles per hour because of the spinning Earth. Doesn't seem possible. And I could take my knife out and throw it up in the air, and if we're spinning, we ought to spin out from underneath there, right? Okay? Before it comes back down. Or if we're going around the sun in a big orbit, we must be going 100,000 miles per second around the sun. I may have gotten the speed is enormous, I've forgotten the amount. And if we're going that fast around the sun, there ought to be enormous winds that would blow us off the Earth. Okay? And so I could argue with you that this is a theory that should be presented, and it makes good sense, logically, except that it doesn't obey the laws of physics. And we could spend some time teaching that theory as well. But each theory that we present, scientists have demonstrated that they're bad science, and there's no point teaching bad science. I need enough time that I can get to teach the things that we do know that are right. I say the appeal for fair play, I mean, you can do this, but you're going to make scientists spend a lot of time with things that they've long since disproven. The last argument that I would give you, that if you allow these people to legislate what good science is, or to tell the scientists what they must teach, then you're going to destroy science and destroy the ghost or whatever. This happened in Germany. Hitler legislated a certain kind of physics. It was the only kind of physics that could be taught, and this is why Einstein came to this country. There was a mass exodus of scientists out of that country because of that legislation. Russia has tried it, because they have legislated that only certain kind of biology could be taught, I think so. And it cut back Russia about 30 years in terms of the genetic development of their farm products and so on. So it's very dangerous to tell scientists what they must teach. I know there's some of you wanting to get in here on this about Russia. I think the alternative is that we can have a Genesis story in which it is a historical event that actually happened, that what God has written there in Genesis is true. And let me give you some arguments here. You will have to go to these books because of the time limit. When we tell stories about Jesus, we look at the four Gospels. This is a historical event that occurred, but each of the books are not written in chronological order. Each author picks a topic and develops it. It's topological. I think that you can find the Genesis story has taken topics and developed them to present ideas. Genesis probably was created in, quote, 6 days, 6 periods of time. But if you look up the word bara and do some exegesis on this and see how it's used throughout the rest of the Bible, you'll discover that God talks about creating Israel. And this is not an instantaneous event, but a process that went through a period of time. You can read in John, the 5th chapter, verses 10 through 17, in which Jesus has healed a man that was sick on the Sabbath day. I guess I should preface this by saying what happened on the 8th day or the 9th day. You'll find on the first 6 days that there was a morning and an evening, but on the 7th day you don't find any reference to a morning and evening. The 7th day probably is the clue to the other 6 days, that the 7th day is still going. It's still in process. And Jesus on the Sabbath day, when God is supposed to rest, heals somebody, so that he's telling us that resting, he also works on those days, and he has mercy, and he heals people. And so the day is going on, and it is a process. And so the 7th day may be a clue to the other 6 days. And if this is true, then it makes it possible to say the other 6 days are a period of process of time.